It was the buzzword of the summer.
You know, they show up in the helmets and the black masks, and they've got clubs and they've got everything. Antifa!
Even though everyone seems to say it differently.
Antifa.
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 This week on The World in Words, Antifa. Or Antifa.
And just a warning, the podcast this week is going to have explicit language and content. So if you're in the car with the kids, you may want to listen later. Before we talk about Antifa, or Antifa, though, we do have to learn how to pronounce it right, Nina?
Right.
There's no set way.
Here's Lydia Jean Cott to the rescue.
So Antifa is short for anti-fascist, and it's the name of a political movement. And I've talked to lots of different people, and they've all pronounced it in lots of different ways.
Yeah, so I guess anti-fascists aren't that into rules, huh?
Yeah, exactly. But here's how one Antifa activist, he didn't want me to use his real name, so I'm going to call him Peter. Here's how he says it.
So I pronounce it Antifa.
So Antifa.
Yeah, and let's go with Peter's pronunciation, at least for this story, because this is kind of really Peter's story. How did you start organizing? Like, did you Google Antifa?
It was really just like just getting involved in even just like more basic community organizing in any sort of group like that. There's going to be somebody who's like down for a little bit more. And then, you know, you talk to that person, you meet somebody else who's kind of down for a little bit more. And it's sort of, there are just people around who are kind of willing to take it one step further.
Peter is from Charlottesville. Again, that's not his real name. He didn't want me to use his real name because he doesn't want to become a target for white nationalists. He's a college student with dark rimmed glasses and a shy, closed-lipped smile, studying physics and philosophy. I first reached out to him back in July.
Hey, how are you?
Good, yeah, sorry about that. I just, like, forgot my login.
He was living at his parents' house and working a summer job between his sophomore and junior year of college.
Oh, that's totally fine. I haven't used Skype in years either.
The word Antifa was just starting to appear in the news, and I wanted to learn more about it from someone directly involved.
For me, Antifa means just a movement that's dedicated to resisting all forms of oppression. And generally those tend to lead towards an anti-capitalist movement. Not everybody who's involved is an anti-capitalist, but that is a pretty predominant part of the ideology.
Peter is careful when defining Antifa because Antifa isn't one organized group. There's lots of different groups and different people associated with Antifa who aren't really part of any group at all. But most people who are involved do tend to be pretty far left. And the one thing that they all have in common is that they believe in no platforming. That's a word for doing everything you possibly can to keep racists and fascists from spreading their ideas by expressing their views in public. That can mean publicly shaming them or even physically confronting them. Like, for example, in Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day, what looked like an Antifa activist punched the white supremacist Richard Spencer in the face while he was giving an interview.
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
That video went viral. It got remixed to endless songs, including Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture.
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol. Kind of a symbol.
And that's around the time Peter got on board.
I know for me, certainly, I really would not have considered any of this kind of organizing to even be necessary before Donald Trump was elected.
So back in July, for Peter, his involvement with Antifa, it was still pretty new.
Have you participated in any sort of like violent protests or violent actions?
I personally have not. However, yeah, there is a lot to talk about for that. So if you have a more specific question.
So like you wouldn't be opposed in certain situations using violence?
Correct. But I also believe that nonviolent action should be always the first step. But there are going to be people who, and especially on the far right, who, as I guess we all know, they have a very big thing for guns and for us to stand around and not be prepared to defend ourselves is an absurd idea.
At the time, I thought of this conversation between me and Peter as theoretical. I was wrong. One reason why Antifa is so difficult to define is because it's not actually in the dictionary.
What do you mean by that?
Like,
It's not in Merriam-Webster, at least. It's a term that they're watching or tracking to see if it gets used enough to eventually get added.
Oh, so where did the term originally come from?
I asked Mark Bray that. He's a history professor at Dartmouth and the author of a book that's actually called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. And here's what he told me.
The anti-fascist movement is as old as the fascist movement. It originated in the early 20th century in response to the rise of Benito Mussolini and fascism in Italy and its expansion elsewhere.
So the roots of the word Antifa also start in Italy. When Mussolini was coming to power, there was this paramilitary group called the Black Shirts, and they would go after and just beat up the people that didn't agree with him. And a lot of those people were leftists. So leftists came together and formed their own militias to kind of fight back. And since Mussolini's party was called the National Fascist Party, when the English-speaking press was writing about what was going on in Italy, they referred to those people who opposed Mussolini as anti-fascists.
Anti-fascists. Wow. Okay. So that's anti-fascist. But what about Antifa, the abbreviation? Did that start around the same time?
A little later, and it started in Germany. When Hitler was coming to power, he copied Mussolini, and he had a paramilitary group that beat up anybody that didn't agree with him. That group was called the Brown Shirts. And they also particularly went after leftists. So again, leftists formed their own groups to fight back. And one of those groups, excuse my German, I don't really know how to pronounce it, but it was called Antifascistische Action. And because that's kind of hard to say, it became known as Antifa for short.
Die Kommunistische Partei Deutschlands ruft euch zur antifaschistischen Aktion auf.
So this is a speech by an organizer named Ernst Schneller. He's calling for social democrats and communists to come together and join the fight against the Nazis under the mantle of this group, Antifascistische Action.
Sozialdemokratische Partei und Gewerkschaftsmitglieder. Eure Führer reden auch von der Einheitsfront.
So what then happened to that group and others like it when World War II actually broke out?
They all pretty much were crushed.
Crushed. So it failed.
Yeah, it failed. But I mean, I guess what Antifa activists would say, that maybe if people had really all come together, like that guy Ernst Schneller wanted them to do, like all these different leftist disparate groups, which didn't really, but if that had happened, and if they had understood the urgency of this cause, then maybe they would have been able to stop Hitler from rising to power, and history would have been entirely different.
So many scenarios in which history would have been entirely different. Going back to the word Antifa, how did this nickname for this group that fought the Nazis in the 1930s become the name of an entire movement here now in 2017?
So let's skip ahead 50 years. Here's Mark Bray.
The term was sort of revived largely, I'd say, in the 80s out of initially West Germany and then a united Germany as neo-Nazis and far-right movement became resurgent with the fall of the Berlin Wall.
So some leftist radicals were feeling like the German government at the time wasn't doing enough to combat the violence that was coming from racist far-right groups. So they decided to take matters into their own hands and fight these groups themselves. And a lot of these groups, they hearkened back to the 30s as a way to gain legitimacy.
Oh, right. So did they have the same Antifa names as back in the 30s?
Yeah, I should probably say a lot of them had the word Autonome at the top of their name because that was the name of this broader leftist movement, kind of like the squatter movement that these groups came out of. So, for example, one of these groups was called Autonome Antifa Berlin. Another was called Autonome Antifa parentheses M because I think they met on Wednesdays, and the German word for Wednesday starts with M. And there was even a coalition that was actually called Antifascistische Action, Antifa for short. And the iteration of this movement, it wasn't limited to Germany. So similar groups were also popping up in the UK. And they didn't really use the term Antifa, but there was a coalition called Anti-Fascist Action, which is, of course, a direct translation of Antifascistische Action.
Okay, but they're dealing with a completely different situation than the 1980s, right? I mean, they're fighting fascism, but fascists are not running the government. Presumably, they're fighting fascists who want to run the government. They're very different from the 1930s.
Yeah, but I mean, like, they still viewed this rise of far-right movements as a big problem. And I kind of want to focus on the UK for this section because what was going on there really influenced what happened in the United States pretty directly.
So a lot of the confrontations in the UK, they were actually happening at punk concerts between skinheads and anti-racist skinheads. And they were fighting over who was going to have control over the music scene. So this is an early 90s song by the Scottish band Oi Polloi, and it became this stereotypical anti-fascist anthem. I don't know if you can quite make it out, but they're saying, bash the fash.
Yeah, you can hear it.
And it's through the punk movement that anti-fascism spread to the United States. This is a song by the American band, the Dead Kennedys. And it actually came out in 1981, but Jello Biafra, the lead singer, he said in an interview for the LA Times that when he wrote it, he was just thinking about the people who were coming to his concerts and acting really violently. Like, they didn't have mosh pits yet, but basically making mosh pits, and it was annoying when they got too violent. But over time, it kind of evolved into this anti-fascist anthem.
So it sounds actually like people weren't using the word Antifa, but like using anti-fascist instead of Antifa. Is that correct?
Actually, they weren't really using either term. Here's Mark Bray again.
In the United States, this politics was largely put into place initially starting in the late 80s by a network called Anti-Racist Action that really grew to its peak in the 1990s and was a network of autonomous chapters of leftists of various stripes who believed to some extent that the language of anti-racism was more palatable to the American public than anti-fascism. It was more tangible to the American political context.
Anti-Racist Action, that network that Bray's talking about, it started in Minneapolis in 1987. A group of punks, they were basically teenagers, called the Baldies.
The Baldies.
They were worried about these new neo-Nazi groups in their city. And one of them had read in this British anarchist magazine about anti-fascist action, and she was inspired. So the Baldies decided to start something similar in the United States, but to call it anti-racist action instead. Because, yeah, as Bray said, they figured more people would relate to the word racist than the word fascist, so it was a better PR move. It would mobilize people better. Smacking up some fascists like I'm Dr. Jones.
We take it Pepe back. Leave that frog alone. But there now are groups in the United States that call themselves Antifa, right? Not anti-racist action, not anti-fascist action, but Antifa.
Yeah, there's groups with that name that started popping up in the 2000s. And it grew a lot in 2016, and it continued to grow. The group NYC Antifa says that their number of Twitter followers almost quadrupled in just the first 3 weeks of January. That was right after the inauguration.
Part of what makes Antifa such a controversial group, from what I've been reading, is their use of violence, or that they are considered violent, or they've been portrayed as violent in the media. What have you heard from different activists that you've spoken with about the violence?
I mean, it's undeniably a part of the movement. I haven't talked to any pacifist Antifas. I don't think that really exists. And I really tried to understand why they think that violence makes sense as a strategy. And I just got the sense that they feel really frustrated, and they feel like the way things are going right now is so bad that they have this responsibility to take matters into their own hands in maybe kind of a radical way and actually do something actively about the fascists and racists in our society, or else things will get worse.
We've been trying to tell people that these people were waiting in the wings. These people were out there all this time. And we kept on telling folks, yo, we gotta do something about these folks because they're trying to step up.
Daryl Lamont Jenkins is 49 years old. He lives in Philly. He's a former U.S. Air Force police officer. But for the past almost 20 years, he's been running an organization called One People's Project that monitors hate groups. And he feels like he's just been watching these groups grow and grow, and no one's been listening to him or doing anything about it.
We got the usual blowback from liberals telling us, they're not going to cause any harm. Just ignore them. They have their freedom of speech. Why are you attacking them for their beliefs? And we were trying to tell people, no, these folks are in politics. These guys work with folks that are in Congress right now. You can't ignore that, or they're going to do something really bad.
So Daryl goes to far-right conferences and rallies himself, and he publishes the personal information of the people that he meets at these things online in order to publicly shame them.
Known as doxing, right?
Exactly. That's like a common Antifa tactic. But Daryl's a bit of an anomaly. He's much older than the other Antifa activists I've spoken to, and he's also Black, while everyone else I've interviewed is white. I called him up a couple weeks after the first time I met with him and asked him about why he's chosen to align himself with Antifa in particular.
My thing is, whenever you are dealing with this particular element, things are going to get hot. It isn't a matter of Antifa decides, yeah, we're going to be more aggressive than the others. No, it's a matter of got to recognize the threat that neo-Nazis and the Klan have posed in the past and pose currently. So I'm just recognizing reality for what it is. And I say, okay, I am going to prepare myself for that.
That's why Daryl says he brings a gun to protests and rallies, although he's never used it.
Wait a minute, he brings a gun with him?
Well, if it's like an open carry or a concealed carry state, if it's legal, yeah.
Oh, wow. Maybe it's just because I'm a Brit, but that to me just seems like an incredibly provocative thing to do.
But lots of people from both sides are bringing guns to these rallies.
Also, lots of Americans just have guns who are unrelated to Antifa.
Yeah.
Or the right or anything. People have guns here.
Patrick, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms.
Why do I live in this country?
Okay, so bringing a gun and carrying it on you for self-defense, that is one thing. But how far are these Antifa activists willing to go to stop what they see as fascist behavior? Will they use the gun?
There's no consensus, I guess you probably won't be surprised to hear, about what Antifa activists will and will not do. Some believe it's okay to beat up anybody that they think is a Nazi, which we have seen happen. But there are others who are against using any sort of violence at all, except when they absolutely have to. And everyone that I've talked to personally, they've really emphasized that the whole point of Antifa is to do everything they can to make people feel safe. But, I mean, it is important to note that Antifa has also been associated with violent acts that don't really seem like they have anything at all to do with protecting people. Like, for example, on Inauguration Day in D.C., there's videos of what look like Antifa activists smashing a Starbucks window with clubs, overturning trash cans, just causing general mayhem and destruction.
This really is reminiscent for me of Germany. I was in Germany earlier this summer and doing a bunch of reporting. And at this one right-wing rally in Dresden, all of the speakers kept saying again and again, don't be provoked by the left-wing counter-demonstrators. Behave yourselves. Don't be like the G20 protesters in Hamburg, which had just taken place. There had just been, in July, a meeting of the G20, and three nights in a row, there were riots from, I think, a lot of people who might identify themselves as Antifa, but certainly a lot of anti-globalization protesters, et cetera, et cetera. They caused millions and millions of euros worth of damage to local stores. It was a great embarrassment to the German government. And here was this right-wing group saying, let's not be like them. You know, and there's an argument. This was in Dresden, in Saxony, where when the German elections came along in September, a couple months later, they did really, really well, the right-wing group. They got, I think, over 20% of the vote in Saxony. They seem to win the argument.
So it's bad PR, is what you're saying. This kind of
horrible
violence is
PR.
Like, it's not just what, aside from the acts themselves, it's the look of it on the face of it.
Like, you feel like they did better because the left was viewed as this, like, crazy anarchist thing, and they were going to bring order, kind of.
Absolutely. But maybe that's not the goal of Antifa.
Well, the goal is, like, no platforming, right?
But if their whole message is, okay, stop the fascists, then they do something that arguably encourages more voters to vote for the neo-fascist party. I mean, it makes no sense.
Yeah. That's a good point. And there are actually Antifa activists in the United States who are worried about that and are really troubled by video footage of these random acts of violence happening. And I talked to one man. His name is David John from Portland, Oregon.
And he told me that this is a problem that some are really trying to address seriously within Antifa.
There are individuals who might look like what people assume would be an Antifa member, quote unquote, and they do dumb stuff. Community organizers take that kind of thing very seriously and do their best to discourage people from creating chaos for the sake of chaos, you know, or victimizing somebody else.
And as opposed to Daryl Lamont Jenkins, David John says that while he does own a gun and usually carries it on him, he never brings it to protests or rallies because he believes that's irresponsible to have a gun in such a tightly enclosed space with lots of people.
Right. Okay. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that within Antifa, voices like those are kind of the minority.
I think that that's actually kind of hard to say at this point. I mean, Antifa is still really new in the U.S., and I think it's still trying to figure out like what it's going to look like and what it's going to be later down the line. So the first time I talked to Peter, that Antifa activist from the beginning of the podcast, he told me about this rally that was happening soon in his hometown.
Coming up later in August, we are going to have a large group of far-right people come to Charlottesville under the guise of, I think it's the Unite the Right rally.
When is that going to be?
That will be August 12th, I believe.
I borrowed my parents' car and drove to Charlottesville. I wanted to meet Peter in person and see Antifa in action. Peter texted me on this encrypted messaging app called Signal to suggest a meeting place.
He says, by the Wells Fargo sign opposite the park towards the mall, I have a dust mask around my neck and wearing...
I read his text to my younger sister Julia and my younger brother Xander. My siblings came with me to Charlottesville because I didn't want to go alone. When we get to the park, the counter-protesters and the white nationalists are staking out their positions. Where's Julia?
I'd rather not be a shield.
Yeah.
We're laughing, but it's nervous laughter. Things are scary. The white nationalists are holding flags with Nazi symbols. The counter-protesters are holding signs that say things like, smash white supremacy. And everyone seems to be itching for a fight.
Fuck you, fat and pieces!
And there's these guys in uniform patrolling the area.
Wait, are the people with assault rifles National Guard?
Yeah, those aren't National Guard or police. They're Trump-supporting militiamen. Peter texts me saying, actually, maybe don't come here. But by that point, we've already found the Wells Fargo. We don't see Peter. But I quickly figure out why he wanted me to stay away. Things are escalating. I go up to a group of what look like Antifa activists.
Hi, can you do an interview?
Someone throws a water bottle at me. In the chaos, it's hard to tell who, but I think it's come from the side of the white nationalists. And then my recorder goes dead. I get it working again after a while.
I mean, the whole thing has been scary. Like, anybody who's telling you otherwise is lying through their teeth.
I finally meet up with Peter after the police had shut down the rally and people are starting to disperse. We only talk for a few minutes. His hands are stained from throwing a tear gas canister from his side to the other side.
There are still a lot of people here that we don't want here. And, you know, so hopefully the events of the rest of the day and maybe going into tomorrow a little bit will convince them that they don't want to come back.
Peter has heard that white nationalists are gathering in a different park, and he's going there next. We go back to our hotel room and turn on the TV.
Breaking news, a horrific scene in Charlottesville, Virginia. A white nationalist rally that descended into deadly violence and chaos.
And then I get a text from Peter. It says he's in the hospital.
A number of severe injuries, many life-threatening.
He'd been hit during the car attack. His injuries are minor, just cuts and bruises. He's home by the end of the day. He's lucky. I still can't really look at the photos or videos. They show people flying through the air, shoes scattering the sidewalk.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides.
What was your reaction when you heard Trump's response to Charlottesville?
Well, do you want me to go first, Patrick?
Sure.
It was really kind of saddening, but not surprising to me.
I was surprised. You know, I was really surprised. I was really shocked. I think I still have that ability almost every day in this presidency to be kind of shocked.
Okay, good. So you're less jaded than I.
To a degree. Maybe it's just sort of working more on me, but I was really shocked.
How about you, LJ?
I felt like maybe I shouldn't do this podcast.
Why?
Well, it became pretty clear in the days and weeks afterwards that Trump was creating this narrative.
What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt?
Where the white nationalists and what he termed the alt-left were equal.
I think especially in light of the advent of Antifa, if you look at what's going on there, you know, you have some pretty bad dudes on the other side also.
And I was just worried about creating something that supports this narrative in any way.
This term, alt-left, was Trump the first person to sort of coin this term, alt-left, or had it been in the ether?
People had used it here and there, like conservative commentators, even liberal commentators, basically just as an insult to disparage people. But Trump, he brought it to a whole new level. And that was because he mobilized an army of people behind it. I talked to Tim Squirrel about this. He's a researcher at the University of Edinburgh, and he studies online communities, especially the forum Reddit. And he told me about what he saw happen to the term alt-left after Trump used it.
It was like night and day, looking at it before and after Charlottesville. The only time that the words alt and left came together in a comment in most places before Charlottesville were people in gaming forums talking about the characters on a keyboard, whereas afterwards it just became this massive, massive thing.
What were people actually saying on Reddit?
So Squirrel used a word association algorithm to figure that out, and he found that the word alt-left appeared in nearly a quarter of comments with the word violent. And Antifa did worse. It appeared in half of the comments that used the word violence in August. Squirrel views this as a result of a concentrated campaign to basically distract from any violence on the right and emphasize the violence on the left.
So what actual impact did this sort of online campaign have in the real world?
I don't know how to measure that. I don't know if it's been measured. But I definitely found during the course of my reporting, like when I started and I asked people about what they thought about the word Antifa, most people had never heard of it. And
back in July, that is.
Back in July, exactly. And then by the end, when I was finishing up this story, everyone knew what Antifa was, and a lot of people felt pretty negatively about the movement. And Tim Squirrel thinks that that is in part thanks to efforts like this.
The reason that it has changed in connotation is as a result of a concerted effort by the Trump administration, by members of the alt-right on Twitter and Reddit and various other platforms, and also by Russian-controlled and pro-Russian bots and users on Twitter who consistently attempted to post images of Antifa or associate images of Antifa with violent acts.
Russian bots?
I had no idea that they were involved in this story.
And so what exactly are they tweeting? Like, Antifa, bad, violent. Like, what exactly is out there?
Well, for example, in late August, there was a far-right rally in Berkeley, and Antifa activists came out to protest it. And those Russian bots, they were all over it.
They made Antifa a massive hashtag when the Berkeley protests were ongoing. So they basically associated Antifa with Berkeley rather than associating it with right-wing extremism.
And this is still going on.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. I called Peter a few times in the weeks after Charlottesville just to check in. The first time we talked, I asked him about the car attack, but he said he's had to describe it too many times already.
Yeah, it's been a lot of talking about it, and I've driven past the memorial site quite a few times, and it's still it's a little bit too hard to see and to talk about too much right now.
I asked him about how he thought this would affect him from now on.
I guess for better or for worse, this is definitely going to be one of the most significant moments in my life, I think, and it hasn't managed to break me. So I hope to come out of this with lessons on how to be stronger and how to be better, how to keep people safer.
And in one of our later conversations, Peter told me that he hopes what happened in Charlottesville will make him better. But not only him, he also hopes it will make all of us better as well.
This is what makes things change. And it's hard to say what actual changes are going to come from, you know, the specific weekend of August 12th. But I don't think it would be a stretch to say that August 12th is going to have some very long-lasting effects on the way that our country is shaped in the future and the way that we kind of move forward as a society.
Yeah, I think things feel different now.
I don't want to make any bets, but I'm thinking the word Antifa. Maybe word of the year, Patrick?
Oh, it's got to be on the short list at least, yeah. And in the dictionary. And maybe there'll be some guidelines for pronunciation.
Right.
Or maybe we don't care. Maybe it'd be a gift.
I think that would be like antithetical to Antifa,
exactly.
To have a way to pronounce it.
Exactly.
That's only one way.
And then that is sort of beside the point. The point is that this word has a major impact in a very short period of time. And who knows how it will change and morph in the future.
And what's so weird is that we think of it as a new word, but Lydia Jean, as you've explained to us, it's anything but.
But in a way, it's a new word, right? Like, it's been around since the 1930s, but we haven't needed it till now, which is kind of disconcerting.
Thanks so much this week to many people, to Tina Toby for engineering and mixing this podcast. Thanks to Jonathan Dyer, who is one of our most dedicated listeners.
We know you're listening.
We know you're listening.
Thank you, JD.
Maybe in an ATM on Cape Cod.
Maybe. And thanks, of course, to Lydia Jean for delivering this story.
And also thanks to Bryce Ledner, Tanu Kumar, Maria Muriel, Jared Rosenfeld, Julia Cott, Xander Cott, Michael Cott, and Tara McKelvey.
And thanks to Miss Eves for letting us use the track 404 Not Found. And most importantly, thanks so much for listening.